13. 80-20 for everyone. Lots of people take up running as a way to lose weight. In a recent survey by Running USA, concerns about weight ranked as the second most commonly cited reason for starting a running program, behind only the generic for exercise. Research indicates that running is a smart choice for the weight loss seeker. Numerous studies have shown that people who select running as their primary form of exercise lose more weight than do people who choose other fitness activities. In a 2012 study, for example, Paul Williams of the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory compared the effects of running and other forms of exercise on body mass index, BMI, and waist circumference in a population of more than 33,000 men and women. He found that the waist-reducing effect of running in women was 9.5 times greater than that of other forms of exercise, and in men, the BMI-reducing effect of running was 19.3 times greater. Why is running so much more effective for weight loss than other activities? Some experts believe it is because runners tend to measure their workouts in terms of distance covered instead of time elapsed. It takes the same amount of energy for a person of a given weight to run a mile at any speed, whereas the effectiveness of 30 minutes of Zumba or water aerobics depends on how much the exerciser puts into it. We've all seen people who go to the gym and float in the pool or move in apparent slow motion on a stair-climbing machine, failing to get their heart rate up even into the low-intensity exercise range. Yet running also yields more weight loss than activities such as walking and swimming that are typically measured by distance covered as well. So there must be some other factor at work. This other effect may have something to do with running's effect on appetite. People tend to eat more after walking or swimming than they do after running. This is all very interesting, but from the perspective of the average person looking to lose weight, it doesn't really matter why running works better. It's enough to know that it works better. The goal of losing weight is, of course, rather different from the goal of getting in shape for races, which has been the focus of this book. We have heard that adhering to the 80-20 rule is the most effective way to attain peak running fitness for competitive events. But is it also the most effective way to lose weight? As we shall see in this chapter, the best evidence from science and the real world indicates that it is. While many people start running to lose weight, they keep running for other reasons. This shift is partly explained by the fact that people who keep running usually attain their weight loss goals. But it is also explained in part by the fact that people whose primary motivation for running is weight loss tend to quit early. Running is hardly unique in this way. Weight loss is not a strong motivator for long-term adherence to any exercise program. Few people exercise consistently year after year unless they enjoy working out. Those new runners who eventually become seasoned runners do so because they develop a passion for running. Running USA reports that more than three-fifths of experienced runners cite having fun as one of the main reasons they keep at it. Even the most passionate runners sometimes get bored with the same old routine, however. When they do, they often branch out from running into new challenges such as triathlon. Should runners who dabble in other endurance sports apply the 80-20 rule in them as well? Again, the best evidence from science and the real world indicates they should. 80-20 weight loss. If you wander down to your local health club and hire a personal trainer to help you lose weight, there's a pretty good chance he or she will put you on a program that consists of 3 strength workouts and 3 cardio workouts per week. And it's also very likely that each of those cardio workouts will be a high-intensity interval session. How do I know? Because this has been the standard exercise formula for weight loss since Bill Phillips popularized it with his book Body for Life in 1999. The absence of longer, less intense cardio workouts in this formula is easy to explain. Bill Phillips was a bodybuilder. Like most bodybuilders, Phillips looked at cardiovascular exercise as a necessary evil to be gotten over with as quickly as possible. The average personal trainer has the same mindset. A passion for long trail runs is not likely to lead someone to take a job in a machine-packed, artificially lighted health club. Having little or no experience with low-intensity cardio exercise, personal trainers never think to include it in the programs they supply to their weight loss clients. The mass media have done their part to entrench the standard exercise formula for weight loss by hyping up high-intensity interval training as a time saver. Fitness magazines and websites profit most when they tell people what they want to hear, and people want to hear that they can obtain the body of a professional athlete by spending less time working out than they do brushing their teeth. This point was made in a 2013 review of previous research on the use of high-intensity exercise for weight loss, whose author, Pier Paolo De Feo of the Healthy Lifestyle Institute in Perugia, Italy, wrote, "In our demanding society, the most attractive messages in the popular press are those promising the best results in a short time." This might explain the emphasis given by the media to those scientific articles that report the efficacy on weight loss of exercise programs of shorter duration and higher intensity. While it's true that most people today are busy, nobody is really too busy to exercise. Surveys have shown that people who exercise regularly have just as much going on in their lives as do those who avoid exercise. The real reason why many new and prospective exercisers are attracted to short workouts is that they can't stand working out, and therefore they wish to invest as little time in it as possible. The problem is that people who don't enjoy exercise especially don't enjoy high-intensity exercise. Once they have been exposed to the tortures of high-intensity interval training, most weight loss seekers would gladly spend more time exercising at a lower intensity. Indeed, research has revealed that the dropout rate in high-intensity weight loss exercise programs is significantly higher than it is in low-intensity programs. Even when the factors of enjoyment and adherence are removed from the equation, an exercise program that combines a lot of low-intensity exercise with a little moderate and high-intensity exercise is more effective for weight loss than is the standard interval-based formula. The main reason is that low-intensity exercise is significantly less stressful, so a person can tolerate far greater amounts of it without feeling overtaxed. When scientists compare the effects of exercise at different intensities on weight loss, they usually match them by time or energy. They ask questions such as which program yields more weight loss, X minutes or kilojoules per week of low-intensity exercise, or the same amount of high-intensity exercise. But factors such as time and energy are not the true determinants of how much a person invests in his or her exercise routine. It is really done by feel, or more precisely, by perceived effort. Each workout imposes a psychological burden on a person, which scientists measure with a tool called a session RPE. This variable is calculated by multiplying the athlete's overall sense of effort in a workout as rated on a 1 to 10 scale by the duration of the session in minutes. There is a limit to the cumulative amount of session RPE that a given exerciser is willing to tolerate from week to week, and this limit is the true determinant of each person's commitment to exercise. Widespread testing of this tool has shown that relatively short, high-intensity workouts feel just as challenging to runners as do very long, low-intensity workouts that burn far greater numbers of calories. This is important because the sum of session RPEs that an individual runner can tolerate from week to week is the same, regardless of whether he or she trains mostly at low intensity or mostly at high intensity. Runners, therefore, are able to burn far more total calories each week without exceeding their stress tolerance if they keep the intensity low most of the time. Table 13.1 in the bonus PDF shows two running programs, an 80-20 program and a high-intensity program, that are about equal in terms of perceived stress, but are very different in terms of the total number of calories burned. The 80-20 program does require a greater time commitment, but a runner who tries both schedules will not find the 80-20 program to be any more psychologically burdensome, yet it burns more than twice as many total calories. Considering all of this, you might ask, Why should I not do all of my training at low intensity if my goal as a runner is to lose as much weight as possible? It's a good question with a simple answer. The reason it's better to include some running at higher intensities in a weight loss program is that your overall fitness will improve more this way. And as your fitness improves, you will run faster and burn more calories at all intensities, even low intensity. The comparison made in Table 13.1 in the bonus PDF is hypothetical, but it is consistent with what happens in the real world. Millions of men and women have succeeded in losing weight through running, and the vast majority of them have not done so with high-intensity interval-based programs. Indeed, I've never met anyone who has lost a lot of weight by sprinting on a treadmill at a health club under a personal trainer's supervision. But I've met scores of people who have fallen in love with running and have lost weight almost as a side effect of training for 5Ks, 10Ks, half marathons, and marathons. Even these runners could do better, though, in many cases. As I've already demonstrated, nearly all recreational runners spend too much time running at moderate intensity, day after day, making the same compromise between the desire to get their run over with quickly and the desire not to suffer. The few who follow the 80-20 rule tend to lose the greatest amount of weight most steadily. One such runner is Amanda from Richmond, Virginia. Amanda kept her body lean and fit through athletics in high school, but then she quit sports in college and gained some weight. And then she met her husband, Michael, and gained some more. When she was 30 years old, Amanda reached a new peak weight of 195 pounds, and she decided enough was enough. Completely inactive at the time, Amanda started to use strength workout videos at home and to do very short runs of a mile or so around her neighborhood. At the same time, she made sensible changes to her diet, such as cutting out soft drinks, cooking with less meat and more vegetables, and eating out less often. Amanda had been running for a few months and had completed 2 5Ks and 1 10K when she discovered Pair Mobile, the heart rate-based coaching app that I first mentioned in the introduction. She used my Level 1 half marathon program, which is based on the 80-20 rule, to train for her first 13.1 miler. As most runners do when they are first exposed to this way of training, Amanda discovered that she was forced to run a lot slower, as much as 2 minutes per mile slower, than she was accustomed to doing. At first, she resisted being held back, doubting that such easy jogging could do her much good. But before long, Amanda embraced the program because it freed her from the disappointment she had always felt when training by pace and setting time goals that she couldn't achieve. Training had become more enjoyable than ever, and her progress accelerated. Running only a few miles was a struggle for Amanda when she started the program, but when it was over, she finished her half marathon with ease, beating her goal time by 4 minutes. 10 months after she started her 80-20 running journey, Amanda stepped on a scale and saw that she weighed 145 pounds. She had lost an even 50 pounds since the start of her new chapter in life. As impressive as Amanda's turnaround was, there are countless others just like it. If you need to lose weight and you commit to 80-20 running, you will end up with a similar story to tell. The Level 1 5K plan presented in Chapter 9 and in your PDF companion is a good choice for beginner runners who are seeking to lose weight. Although the plan was designed to prepare new runners to complete their first 5K event, I wouldn't have made the schedule any different if I had created it expressly to promote weight loss. In fact, I encourage people who take up running for the sake of losing weight to set a goal of completing a 5K or some other short event instead of focusing solely on weight-related goals. Research in the field of exercise psychology has demonstrated that people tend to be more motivated by social goals like finishing a race than they are by private goals like reaching a certain weight. Preparing for a running event is also a more reliable way to fall in love with running. There's a special magic in the feeling of crossing a finish line for the first time that hooks new runners on the sport. 80-20 Triathlon. In 2010, Stuart Galloway and two fellow exercise scientists at the University of Stirling, Scotland, conducted an ambitious study involving recreational triathletes. For 6 months, Galloway's team monitored the training of 10 members of a local triathlon club as they prepared for an Ironman event. 2.4-mile swim, 112-mile bike, 26.2-mile run. The athletes were not coached by the scientists themselves, but instead were self-guided. Heart rate monitors and perceived effort ratings were used to determine how much time the athlete spent at low, moderate, and high intensity in each discipline. Before the study period began, and at various points throughout it, the athletes underwent fitness testing in all three disciplines to determine how well they were responding to their training. It turned out that, on average, the athletes spent 69% of their total Ironman training time at low intensity, 25% at moderate intensity, and 6% at high intensity. That's better than most recreational runners do, probably because the volume of training the triathletes did was relatively high. The subjects logged upward of 11 hours per week at the height of their Ironman preparations. But 69% is still well below the optimal 80% of total training time that endurance athletes should spend at low intensity. You may recall that Jonathan Esteve-Lanau's work has shown that runners who spend 80% of their training time at low intensity improve significantly more than do runners who spend 65% of their training time at low intensity. Perhaps it's not surprising, then, that the participants in Galloway's study showed little improvement in fitness over the six-month period in which they were monitored. Among the fitness tests that the athletes were subjected to periodically were ones that measured their swimming pace, cycling power output, and running pace at lactate threshold intensity, tests that are known to be excellent predictors of performance in actual races. On average, the subject's swimming pace at lactate threshold intensity increased by a trivial 0.7%. Their cycling power at the lactate threshold increased by a greater amount, 3.3%, but this effect was also classified as statistically trivial. Running performance improved the most. The subject's lactate threshold running pace increased by 7.8% over 6 months. This effect was classified as moderate. Interestingly, the subjects came closest to heeding the 80-20 rule in their run training, doing 74% of their total running at low intensity. Galloway and his colleagues concluded that the athletes would have been better off doing 80% of their training at low intensity in all three disciplines. A subsequent study conducted by our friends Stephen Saylor and Jonathan Esteve-Lanau supported this conclusion. The design was similar to Galloway's. 9 recreational triathletes were monitored over a long period of time as they trained independently for an Ironman event. But on this occasion, the amount of time that the individual athletes spent in each intensity zone was correlated with actual performance in the race. As expected, there was a significant inverse correlation between low-intensity training time and race time. Athletes got twice as much benefit from each additional minute of low-intensity training in their program as they got from each additional minute of high-intensity training. The take-home lesson is that if you ever decide to branch out from running to the triathlon, you should be sure to avoid the mistake that most triathletes make and follow the 80-20 rule. The 5-zone intensity scheme that you use for running may also be applied to your swimming and cycling. However, because the lactate threshold heart rate is different for each activity, you will need to establish distinct training zones for swimming, cycling, and running. You can determine your cycling lactate threshold heart rate and power output, if your bike has a power meter, by using the same test you use for running, whether it's a 30-minute time trial, a perceived effort test, or the talk test. The best way to find your lactate threshold pace in the water is with something called the critical velocity test. It's fairly simple. Go to the pool, warm up with some easy swimming, and then swim 400 yards as fast as you can, recording your time. Rest for several minutes, and then swim 200 yards as fast as you can, again recording your time. Use the following formula to calculate your critical velocity, which is also your lactate threshold swim pace. Critical velocity equals 400 yards minus 200 yards divided by 400 time minus 200 time. Let's look at an example. Suppose you swim your 400-yard test in 4 minutes 21 seconds, 4.35 minutes, and your 200-yard test in 2 minutes 2 seconds, 2.04 minutes. Your critical velocity then is 400 yards minus 200 yards divided by 4.35 minutes minus 2.02 minutes equals 86.6 yards per minute. It is customary to express critical speed in the form of time per 100 yards. To make this conversion, divide 100 by your critical velocity. In this example, 100 divided by 86.6 equals 1.15. So your lactate threshold pace per 100 yards is 1.15 minutes, or 1 minute and 9 seconds, which is really fast, by the way. You can determine your swimming lactate threshold heart rate by swimming several laps at your lactate threshold pace and then pausing to check your heart rate. Although there are some heart rate monitors that work in the water, most swimmers and triathletes prefer to monitor and control the intensity of their swim workouts by pace because it's almost impossible to check one's heart rate while swimming freestyle. Table 13.1 in the bonus PDF shows appropriate swim pace targets for the 5-zone intensity scheme. Perceived effort may be used to monitor intensity in cycling and swimming just as it is in running. In all three disciplines, Zone 1 corresponds to ratings of 1 to 2, Zone 2 to ratings of 3 to 4, Zone 3 to ratings of 5 to 6, Zone 4 to ratings of 7 to 8, and Zone 5 to ratings of 9 to 10. In the bonus PDF, there is a 12-week 80-20 training plan that you can follow to prepare for your first Olympic distance triathlon, 0.93 mile swim, 24.8 mile bike, 6.2 mile run, or use as a template to design your own 80-20 triathlon plan. The run workout codes refer to those presented in Chapter 7. The limits of 80-20. Running is not a lifelong sport for everyone. Many passionate runners either choose or are forced to trade running for gentler activities such as cycling and swimming because of age or injury. My father, for example, had a hip replaced in his late 50s and subsequently traded his decades-old running habit for open water swimming, which had been the sport of his youth. If there should ever come a time when you want or need to make a similar switch, and you wish to get the best possible results from your new endurance sport, whatever it may be, then be sure to take the 80-20 rule with you. As we heard in Chapter 3, elite athletes in all endurance sports, including cross-country skiing, cycling, rowing, and swimming, heed this rule because it works better than any alternative. Controlled studies suggest that an 80-20 training intensity distribution is optimal for recreational athletes in these other sports as well. In a 2013 study, for example, Stuart Galloway found that 6 weeks of 80-20 training increased high-intensity endurance capacity in cyclists by 85%, whereas 6 weeks of 57-43 training resulted in a much smaller 37% increase. Arthur Lydiard, the man who developed the low-intensity, high-volume approach to training on which the 80-20 method is based, believed it was the best method of cardiovascular conditioning even in non-endurance sports such as football and track sprinting. Low-intensity, high-volume training was his hammer and every sport under the sun looked like a nail. But it was a bridge too far. Elite athletes in strength, speed, and power sports today base their training on high-intensity workouts that simulate the specific demands of their sports, and studies confirm that this approach works best for them. Lydiard was not omniscient. He made the most important training discovery in the history of running, which led directly to the most important breakthrough since then, namely Stephen Saylor's identification of the 80-20 rule. But he had no business telling wrestlers and the like how to train. So, if someday you give up running in favor of, say, ice hockey, leave behind the 80-20 rule without a second thought and train the way the best hockey players train. There are a few absolute principles in life, and the 80-20 rule is not one of them. It is nothing more than the solution to the single most common training mistake in running and the key to becoming the best, most fulfilled runner you can possibly be. This concludes 80-20 Running by Matt Fitzgerald. Narrated by Rob Gergach. Copyright 2014 by Matt Fitzgerald. Forward copyright 2014 by Robert Johnson. This unabridged audiobook is recorded by arrangement with New American Library, an imprint of Penguin Publishing Group, a division of Penguin Random House LLC, and was produced in the year 2017 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers.